welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we are tickling your airwaves in association with OldFootballShirts.com. Well, after what seems like a lifetime since we last kicked a ball in anger, we're finally back in action this weekend as we head to Villa Park to face a Villa side who have surprised a few people this season, but have also been a little bit Jekyll and Hyde. Let's hope that the villains will be hiding come quarter to five on Saturday. So, a rare 3 o'clock kickoff for the Albion then, which means the ridiculous pay-per-view scheme has been kicked into touch and the game will now be available on BT Sport. So, with no real action to talk about this week, we're delighted to welcome back a stalwart of the Albion, who, as well as making over 200 appearances for the Stripes, has gone on to be an integral part of the Albion community scheme. Oh, and he also once completely and utterly wiped me out in a dodging. But, I said I'd forget about that. I haven't. Please, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back Guy Butters.
Hi, Guy. How are you, mate? Tell us this
story
about...
you. How are you?
Yeah, tell us this story about the Dodgems. I don't know it.
Well, they got in my way. You know, you just got to wipe someone out when they get in your way, ain't you? You know,
well, don't get me wrong. We all want to wipe AD out, but what actually happened?
Good, AD.
Well, basically, it was the Albion Christmas party and I used to have at the Metropole. And all the players were there, and you and I were there, Al.
As my guest.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Guy was in. It was in a dodgem with Charlie Oakway, and he was going around taking out everyone, and he completely utterly broadsided me, and I went flying, and my back was in agony for weeks afterwards. But you know,
Guy, socially distanced high five there, mate.
Yeah, exactly. It was. I think it was a weight ratio, really, that done it. I think, you know, because I had Charlie in the side, obviously, you know, it added to a bit of weight on it. So, you've got to do these things. When someone gets in your way, you know, it's old habits die hard.
Yeah, those parties were fun, though, weren't they? They were really, really good fun. I mean, there was a casino there. There was
table football, wasn't it?
Yeah, I got
a picture of you and me playing against Dean Wilkins.
And Joe Gatting, yeah.
Yeah, he was talking tactics with the baby football, you know, table football. But I mean, you know, yes, I do remember that those dudes there. Kevin Keane used to organise them. And the thing about it was that he did about two or three years in a row. There was the bumper cars, the Dodgems. It was in Hilton, the Cambridge room at Hilton. You're quite right. Is what kind of lunatic thinks it's a good idea to mix beer, wine, champagne, brandy, and bumper cars?
And the little balloon things on your table as well that used to go flying around. Everyone used to blow them up and just fly them around the room.
I forgot there's a picture I've got of actually AD. This is, we're talking about 12, 13 years ago. He's blowing a balloon up and his head is actually pinker than mine could ever be.
that's not possible, Al.
You remember that Steve Red shirt used to wear in the mid-noughties, the really stretchy one? It was an away shirt.
Oh, yeah.
Dark red, yeah? That was the colour of
the beginning one, yeah. The one I associate with Jake Robinson scoring a hat-trick at Huddersfield.
All shirts, to be fair, all shirts that I wore were quite stretchy. They were all quite tight.
But, okay, particularly during lockdown, which leads us nicely onto that. So, Guy, obviously, times are very, very different at the moment for everybody. But how's it been for you?
Yeah, to be fair, from March till, I think, probably end of August, you know, it was in the same boat as everyone in the lockdown. Thankfully then we were sort of reintroduced back to work. I obviously work on in Albion Community on the further education side of it, so we had up to 68 students all itching to get back into football. So we managed to get that underway. It was very difficult because obviously you've got to, you know, make sure that everything's done by government guidelines, you've got to abide by their rules, which made it fun. You're trying to, every session you add, you probably add upwards of 30 students and you're trying to socially distance them in a football match. So that was quite fun. But, you know, it's just little things you have to sort of adjust to, you know, making sure that afterwards that everything was cleansed. You know, you had to sort of spray down the balls and the bibs and the cones and make sure that when you got them all into groups, you had to, and chatting to them, you socially distanced them and everyone was using the hand sanitizers. So we sort of took a little bit of getting used to, but it worked in the end.
Yeah, but I mean, obviously that was from when you were allowed to come back, Guy, but from March, you weren't able to have the interaction with these guys, were you?
No, exactly. So basically what we used to do a lot of stuff online. We got involved with the club's ring around system as well, you know, talking to elderly fans or anyone who sort of lived in the area. They gave me the Southampton and Hampshire area, and it was quite, apart from Heine, who we all know. Yeah, exactly. I was quite surprised by how many Brighton fans there actually were that lived literally around the corner from where I live.
And it was great.
Again, sorry?
You're at the back of Southampton, aren't you?
Yeah, a little place called Hedge End, and it was sort of incorporating places like Fareham, Bishop's Waltham, Eastleigh. They even gave me a couple of Brighton fans that lived on the Isle of Wight to talk to, which is amazing, really. You know, sort of opened my eyes. And genuinely, there was a couple that lived in the next street from me, so I, you know, obviously didn't know. I'm glad they didn't know that I lived there, because, But we've sort of arranged that when it's all sort of, you know, it's all over and done with, we're going to arrange to go up the pub and have sandwich and have a couple of pints, so something good come out of it.
Okay, well, Guy, talk us through that then. So basically, you pick up the phone and you ring someone up and you say, "Hi, it's Guy Butters." I mean, how many of them actually believed you to start with?
I think to be fair, the majority of people that we had to ring was for a reason. You know, they were either infirm or, you know, something they couldn't get out, or they were struggling for access to, you know, getting shopping or any groceries. So it was basically trying to ring people up and see if they were looked after and see how they were getting on. And like you say, I had the odd one or two, I don't think, believed me. Yeah, what I tended to do, I was lucky, I rung them on my work phone, so I left a couple of messages for people to ring me back, and I don't know if they thought it was a bit of a wind-up or not, but in the main, it went down really well. I think overall the club, they were involved with, I think Albion community were involved with providing 12,500 meals on wheels for people all around Sussex. So it's amazing.
Sorry, amazing. How's that work?
Well, yeah, like you said, you've got a lot of people who were still working during the furlough. A lot of people put on furlough, but a lot of members of the team were still working. And I think they had a deal going with them. So they provided 12,500 meals for people around Sussex, which was, the logistics of it were amazing. You know, people going out doing, delivering food and parcels, et cetera.
That's astonishing.
But obviously, with the whole lockdown situation, I mean, it's been an incredibly tough time for all charities. So how have AITC been coping with that?
I think with the Albion, Albion's one in it as well, the thing that the club done.
Yeah.
I think that we got 20% of what they raised as well, with the other 80% going to other charities. So, you know, little things like that kept us going. It was superb. We had to use the furlough scheme in the end. I don't think they really wanted to, but we had to use the furlough scheme, which was, you know, it was obviously for a reason why it's there. But in the meantime, as I said, there were certain people that were working full time that could still carry on putting the word out and getting the stuff done for AITC in the community. And also, like I said, with our students that we do on the further education side of it, we could still sort of draw our funding down from the colleges because they were actually doing their work from home. So it sort of kept things ticking over. It's still sort of getting to the stage where obviously the fundraising department normally will have 5 or 6 events going on throughout the year. And unfortunately, it put pay to all of them. So hence why we're trying to set up a thing called the Albion Challenge at the moment, which, you know, I'm trying to head up.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about the Albion Challenge then, because that is, it's quite the thing. Now, we're going to talk about the one that's actually listed on the website at the moment, but what can you tell me about a game of throw-ins?
Game of throw-ins, I was quite surprised. It's a great name, isn't it? I nicked it off someone. I saw someone was doing a little quiz and I thought, oh, that sounds really good, I'm going to nick that. Basically, what it is, the Albion Challenge, our fundraising department, like I said before, because they haven't been able to do anything since March, they've come up with the idea of trying to do a virtual bike ride, could be a swim, could be a walk. And basically what they're trying to do is cover the distance between the American Express Stadium and other grounds in the Premier League by the end of December 2020.
Okay. So I've got a list of them all here, Guy. So we've got the Amex to... Well, I hate the name of it, but it's the People's Pension Stadium, which is basically Crawley. So that's 22 miles. Amex to some place that they tried to burn down. which is 42 miles. Amex to Spurs, 57 miles. Amex to the King Power Stadium, 144 miles. Amex to Old Trafford, 227. And Amex to St. James's Park in Newcastle, which is 326 miles. Actually, I wonder how far it is actually from the Amex to St. James's Park in Exeter. It's probably further, isn't it?
No, it's not. I think probably Exeter is about... No, I know that Plymouth is 220, so Exeter will be about 190.
Oh, well, there you go. But, I mean, so basically, so how do you get involved in this? And I mean, when I saw this thing about you posting a game of throw-ins, I just had this image of you standing on a touchline with a load of footballs and someone measuring how far you throw it.
It sounds mad. My daughter thought that I was going to do that all the way to St. James's Park virtually. And literally, I went, what world do you live in? I'm going to take throw-ins all the way. I mean, I couldn't stop laughing for about 10 minutes when she sponsored me. You know, it's brilliant that she sponsored me. But she went, how does that work? Your arms are going to ache. What are you on about? Yeah, so I was going to do virtual throw-ins all the way to St. James's Park. But what we're doing on our one, we challenged our further education students to get involved as well. So I've got a staff team that I've picked from AITC and the football club as well. So we've got about 11 in my team. And what we're trying to do, because lockdown's going on now, we've decided to extend our one. So our lot are going to go to St. James's Park and back. So we're going to be trying to do something in the region of 650-odd miles. So hopefully we can do that. But like I said, our further education students have got involved, and some of their team names are good as well. We've got Tiam Busquets. We've got Show Me the Money. Yeah. We've got Bread and Butters. Yeah. And we've got I Can't Believe It's Not Butters. Quite original, but... so they're getting involved. And what you do if you want to get involved to do it, you go to www.albioninthecommunity.org.uk/Albion Challenge. It should be on the website anyway.
It is. And registration for that is £10. You get various things like medals and things for doing that.
I think if you raise £50, you get a medal.
And so basically you can do it, but you can cover the distance by running, by walking, by cycling. If you're cycling, you can call your team Dynamite Bike Light,
swimming, like you say, I think you just have to track the mileage that you do via Strava or Fitbit or something and provide evidence that you've done it.
Yeah. So when does this actually end?
It ends at the end of December this year, so 31st of December. So if you're still around and you're not involved in the celebrations of New Year's Eve, you can get out lastminute.com and finish off your mileage, but hopefully everyone should have completed it by then. Like I say, we've got 11 in my team, so what we've done is we've sort of broke it down. You know, 500 odd miles, we broke it down so that we all roughly do 50 odd miles each, which if you walk the dog, if you work it out, if you walk the dog a couple of miles a day, which I do morning and evening, say, it should take you just about a month anyway, which probably coincides roughly with you finishing at the end of December.
Here's the thing, right? Because you often quite like to tell me the fact that you do the cycling, and as one of those who does get to go to the Amex as a reporter, as part of the press pack, I think we've worked out is it 15 miles on the bike from you to where you are
for
to
me now? Yeah, about that, yeah,
about 15 miles. Now the thing is, you're a keen cyclist, and being on Worthing Seafront, you can either really be up against it, or depends if you're going the other way, then you can just fly. But how about me dropping you in this? I would happily sponsor you, and bearing in mind I'm unemployed, I would happily sponsor you if you were prepared to do this, even if it meant you just going round, I don't know, Preston Park cycle track a few times. I'll leave that one out there for our listener.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to do it. I mean, if people want to sponsor me, I'll happily get involved in that. And
even if we just said just from the Amex to what's the distance of Amex to Selhurst?
42 miles.
42 miles. Well, you should be able to do that in about 5 minutes, shouldn't you?
Well, yeah. Well, we'll see. But yeah, we'll see.
But
so what you should do as well, I think, you know, just set yourself a Just Giving page up and advertise it on here so everyone sponsors you.
Absolutely. Sorry, man.
Happy to do that, guy. And obviously, I mean, it's funny. It was actually you posted this the other day, and I've obviously seen it in the stadium. It's about how long we've been in lockdown. That when you do go to the ground at the moment, and you go to the toilet, the posters are still up for the Blue and White Day in March.
Yes, it was, I guess. The thing is, in the West Stand Upper, where you and I go, AD, they haven't actually touched it. They haven't decorated it. The floors are still grey. They're not blue like they are downstairs. I mean, don't get me wrong, the toilets are still clean. It's all right. It's not as though it's a six-month-old, you know, the blue pineapple is still 6 months old or anything like that, but the posters are still there. And there is a sort of a... There is a kind of a ghost town aspect to it, you know, and it's quite desolate. You've seen it yourself, AD. It's actually horrible. I mean, it's great to go to the game, to the ground, to see your team. I mean, it's nice when you watch on telly, but it is better being there, even if it's an empty stadium. But when you see the rest of the West Stand Upper, which is still fairly undecorated, it's still bricks, it's still concrete, and it's empty on a grey night, there is a kind of a post-apocalyptic sort of view of it, and this is for a new stadium, and it's really not nice, and it will stay with you. But you know, there's nothing to do about it apart from maybe take in some floor paint. But
there's a load of full barrels there as well, Al. I mean,
that beer's going to be 6 months old, mate. It'll probably go home way to the toilet.
Well, you know, it doesn't usually stop me, to be honest. But Guy, as well as the Albion Challenge, there is something else coming up with AITC, which I'm sure a lot of our listeners would like to get involved with, and that's the virtual festive fun run. So tell us, how can you get involved in that?
Well, same again. Like you say, you go onto albionthecommunity.org.uk/virtual festive fun run. I think last year, I think they had something like 300 people doing it, who are mostly dressed in blue and white Santa suits, and they run around the stadium. Obviously, due to it being COVID again, it's going to be another virtual one. And they're encouraging participants to run either 2,000 metres or for 15 minutes, really, which is, they say it's the equivalent of a lap around the Amex Stadium. I'm pretty sure that people could do a lap around the Amex Stadium quicker than 15 minutes. But
even you. You know,
well, I might struggle. I might just tip it on about 14 and a half minutes. But that's if I put a little burst in at the end.
That'd be an interesting thing to consider, is what is one lap of the stadium? I mean, obviously, you've got to measure it, you've got to work out where you're going to measure it from. Is it the walls? Do you take a point that's, I don't know, 10 metres away from, or 5 metres away from the walls, and there's a sort of a virtual lane you put in there? I'd love to know what that lap would be.
I'm thinking normally round a pitch. I think when we used to do laps around a pitch, you're looking just under 400 metres maybe.
So
when you have the seats in and the stands, you probably double that. I should imagine it's probably roughly 800.
750-800 metres would be probably what it is. I mean, if you start, for instance, at the bottom of the stairs by the north stand entrance and then run your way round, so that's... Actually, you're going the wrong way round then, aren't you? No, you need to start at the top of the stairs, run...
Bottom of the ramp.
You run anti-clockwise, which is the way that... The athletes run. So you run anti-clockwise from the top of the stairs round to the bottom of the stairs by the north stand entrance. That'd be an interesting sort of thing to measure. And like you said, that's probably, I reckon it's only 2.5 laps, not 5 of the Amex.
I've seen them do this run, and they usually start it actually at the bottom of down by the station, and then up and around. But just to give you the full blurb on it, and this is obviously on the Albany Community website. We're encouraging families to get in the festive spirit by getting active and taking part in our virtual festive fun run, running 2K or for 15 minutes, the equivalent of a lap around the Amex, as we just say. And this is on the weekend of the 19th to the 20th of December. Registration fees for family packs start at £20, and that's for one adult and one child. And individual adults can register for just £8. So to register for that, go to the Albion the Community website, all the info's there, and get involved. But like I said a minute ago, all of the charities up and down the country are really, really, really struggling at the moment. And the work that the AITC does in and around the community is absolutely priceless. Anything you can do to get involved in that, please do. And just quickly before we move on from AITC, Guy, One of your head honchos just retired, although he is staying involved with Albion in the community. Tell us about your thoughts on Martin Perry.
Oh, I love Martin. Yeah, he's, you know, me and Danny, we still work at the AITC, as you say. Unfortunately, I haven't seen him for a while due to the lockdown, but when we used to, you know, be at the stadium, we were always in Dick's Bar and we always sort of used to bump into Martin, over have a chat over a coffee. You know, he's still got the same energy as he's had ever since I've known him. You know, and he's been a stalwart for the club for God knows how many years. I mean, we'd like to say 25 years plus. Something like that. But, you know, and obviously he's been instrumental in helping with the new stadium, et cetera, as well. So an absolute legend of a man. And like I say, he always finds time to talk and have a good chat. And we have quite a bit of a giggle, you know, talking about maybe it might be something that happened in the game on Saturday. But he's always obviously asking us how we do at AITC because, you know, he was the, you know, in charge. He was the man in charge of it. So, yeah, it's brilliant. Great, great, great man.
Well, I mean, just to rewind there a little bit, Guy. Obviously, I mean, you had dealings with him as a player way back when you signed as well. So, I mean, what was he like in and around the place back when you were playing?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, they used to have a little office at the Withdean. It was sort of next to the pub. And every now and again, you sort of wander in there if you had to go and see and do something. And you always bump into Martin over, he'd be stood in the kitchen trying to make a coffee or something, and I'd always be trying to snaffle all the biscuits.
Yeah.
But he was always, but like I say, very approachable man, always got time for everyone, you know, and you could always have a really good conversation. And to be fair, you know, although sometimes, you know, the place football club and that, they don't like giving things away, etc. He was always willing to sort of like, you know, have a chat and say, well, maybe we've got this plan coming up that we're willing to do. And what do you think of that? He's always asking your opinion on things. And I've got on really well with him. And like I say, you know, his wife has been involved with the football club as well, different capacity as well. So it'd be, you know, he's now sort of going, but not as a such. I hope
he's never going to go.
Exactly. You can never keep him away. But I'd like to say, tremendous man.
How great it is that when you say you catch up with him, it's always in Dick's Bar or it's at the Sportsman. I mean, there's a theme going on here that whenever
We've done a Rotary Club dinner with him once, and the main aim of it was Martin was going to explain about what AITC do and the football club, how far they're coming along, etc. And then my turn was to stand up and people asked me a few questions about my career, whatever. Martin got up and spoke for so long that I literally had 2 minutes at the end, and the bloke invited me back for a separate talk because Martin was talking for the whole hour.
Okay. Oh, well, I mean, there's been a lot of talk, particularly in Raw circles this week, about Withdean and Al posted some old photos of the place. I mean, well,
it's the anniversary of the old away end, the, you know, the Worthing end. I think it's the first game Palace where we lost 3-2 at home. That was the anniversary of it. So I mean, of all sort of like the memoirs that Guy could ever have, and we're still waiting for his autobiography, by the way, complete with colouring in crayons, is, you know, it's you spent sort of like the biggest chunk of your career, not the majority, but the biggest chunk of your career, at a really weird stadium.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about that stand now. One of my favourite memories of my whole career, really, was when we played QPR and I managed to score on Boxing Day, which, it still gets played on Sky Sports News because I think it was the last time we won on Boxing Day. My friends, because I'm a West London boy, so a lot of my friends were in the away end, at the QPR end, and I scored at that end. And I literally, you know, you sort of dream the night before, think, oh, I'd love to score a winning goal against them just to sort of rub it in a little bit. And when I actually did it, I had a plan of sort of pointing them out where they were and sort of waving to them sort of thing, you know, get in there. But because it was so far away, it was like I couldn't see anything. It was just a blur. Yeah. So I just sort of waved in that general direction and put my hands up and that was it.
Was that the game where Charlie broke his leg?
Yeah, it was that free kick. I think it was that free kick that led to the goal, I think. Because I think if you watch the footage, I think you could see him getting stretched off in the background or almost, you know, the physios and that were in the corner where it was. But, and then I always remember getting as you know, I'm not sure if I deserved it or not, but normally when you score, when you go, you normally get man of the match award. And I remember getting it as a bottle of champagne and meeting up with my mates afterwards. And because I don't drink it at all, and I knew they had to get a train back home, I sort of said, yeah, do you want that to take with you? And I won't tell you where they told me to stick it.
But I mean, with Dean, it was a very, very strange life for us. I mean, did you know it used to be a zoo, for instance?
A zoo? I knew there was a few animals playing on there when I was there.
The zoo while we were there, yeah.
Yeah. I always remember the funny one when I used to travel in with Robbie Pethick, and he used to tell me about it before I'd sort of, you know, because I knew him from my Portsmouth days and we used to live near each other. And he always used to tell me about Brighton and where they used to play at the Withdean and that. I played there when I was at Gillingham in the, I think it was the League Cup or something. But he used to tell me about when someone scored a goal and the firework used to go off, a big bang. And I remember he was on the bench once, and every time someone scored, it banged off, and Robbie used to fall over like he'd been shot. He used to fall on the floor like he'd been shot. Yeah, just weird.
Off, the south stand was nearly on fire. There was one time it went off under.
Didn't that one hole appeared in the pitch as well at one stage? Massive hole.
Yes, and the referee, I think, had to sort of get the groundsman into sort of. I think that was the day that that was the time when the club said. Because I think it was the council that had the maintenance of the pitch. They had the contract to maintenance of the pitch. And I don't know if it's a true story or not. And I've asked Martin Perry about it. And he says, well, you know, he sort of gives you that sheepish grin. But they said, it was Ekavere, I think it was. They said, what do you want, a pitch like Manchester United? And they sort of looked around and said, well, actually, can we have something a bit better than that?
But yeah, like you say, it was a weird old place to play at. But some good memories. I mean, it was sort of we didn't really want to play there, let alone what the opposition wanted to do. You know, it was an experience going into them port cabins and getting changed. And yeah.
So you say you played as an opposition player?
I think I was at Gillingham. We played in a League Cup there. I think it was a two leg affair. Right. I can't remember if we drew at your place and then we beat you at our place, or you might beat us. Can't really remember, but I do remember playing there and sort of thinking, God, you know, it's a bit of a strange place. What sort of helped me out a little bit is been at previous clubs, and when we used to go abroad for pre-season, we'd go to Norway or Sweden or somewhere, and a lot of their grounds are similar. You know, like a pitch with an athletics track around it and a small stand. So I was sort of like, I had played in that environment before, so I was sort of a little bit of a bonus for me, but it's still sort of weird when you've got to play there week in, week out.
But isn't it funny that it's probably the worst stadium? Although somehow it managed to get drawn as fourth worst, which says something about what the other three must have been like. But as a stadium, as the fourth worst, I mean, I can't...
Who's worse than ours then?
I have no idea. I think the Bayer Road...
Probably the old Rotherham.
And before their new ground was, I think Bayer Road and God knows, but... The point is that it was a funny thing. It was temporary season. We used to go off to the Gulf every summer. And yet, I can't help but feel, and times when it chucked it down, you know, you hated it. You just think, can't wait for a new stadium, can't wait. But there are times, not always, but, you know, you do look back on it with misty-eyed fondness and reverence. And I think it was ours, and it was just this ridiculous... Anathema.
We played Gillingham. I remember playing Gillingham, obviously my old club, when I was at Brighton. And I think it must have been Boxing Day or somewhere around then, because it was the pitch was frozen for 10 yards by an all stand. It was sort of frozen for a 10-yard strip. And I think what's her name? The Sean, the female linesman.
Massey Ellis.
Not the current one, the one before, you know, the original.
Yeah.
Lady, she slipped and broke her arm, apparently. We didn't know that till after the game. She slipped over. I got on with the game, carried on, but I think she fractured her arm, because I remember the club having to send her some flowers. But that bit was frozen. Wendy and we were 1-0 down in the game.
Yeah,
it could be Wendy Toms, that's it. And that bit was frozen, and we kept saying to the ref, it's unplayable, ref. We're 1-0 down, and we kept saying to him during the first half, you've got to call it off, ref. This is ridiculous. We're 1-0 down, I don't know, but call it off. And then we turned it round, got 2-1 up, and we were going, ref, it's great. And their players were going, ref, you've got to call it off. But I remember that because I think the club had to send us some flowers. I think she slipped over and got on with it. You know, one of them ones where you don't realise what you've done. what you've done till after the game, but I think she cracked a bone in her arm or something.
God.
But then the other thing I remember about Wendy Tom's AD is, I think we were discussing this earlier, is about Lee Steele, his winner against Bristol City. And she was the lines, she was on the line, running the line that day. Everyone was convinced that Lee Steele was about, you know, 4 miles offside. This was the day that Kuipers, I think it was the day that Kuipers just produced save after save after save. It was ridiculous. Then Steele pops up with a last minute winner, which I'm still not convinced he was, but everyone else went, I think, okay, fine, you know, I've not seen the right footage, but she was the one running the
clearly
line.
Clearly onside. Clearly onside.
Clearly onside, yeah.
Well, I mean, that was a very, very special day. I remember it was an early kickoff, and
was it?
Yeah, it was a weird time for the kickoff, but there was this weird light around it. It was Easter time, yeah. Wasn't it? But I mean, that I think that was, we went top that day, and we never looked back since. But yeah, it was wonderful. But anyway, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. This show is brought to you in association with oldfootballshirts.com, and we have a shirt of the week for you, which Guy is going to describe for us now.
Well, this shirt, it's got quite fond memories for me personally, to be honest. It's a blue coloured shirt. It's got sort of diagonal stripes on it, which is dark blue and light blue. And you know them sort of go faster stripes, I call them, on the sides, you know, where it makes you look a bit thinner.
How
it's
much
a different colour. It's got yellow piping on the sides. Near enough impossible, yeah. But in these days, when I wore this, it was a place where I was on loan, so I didn't wear it that long, thankfully. It's the sponsor's name. It was made, by Spall, and the sponsor's Furholm on it with an arrow pointing upwards. It's got yellow trim around the neck as well, yellow and blue trim. But it's got a lot of fond memories of this shirt.
So, Guy, if you wore it, you might as well tell us who it is.
It's Southend United shirt. In, I would hazard a guess, it was roughly around about 1989, 89, 90, around that era.
You'd absolutely nailed it. I mean, when I first saw it, I actually thought it was Wimbledon, but it was... But it was, you absolutely nailed it. It was, this is what Phil had to say about it. This is the 1988 to 1990 home shirt. So you're absolutely spot on with the dates there. Home shirt of the Shrimpers Southend United. And I trust your guest identified it as he wore the shirt during his 18 league appearances and 3 goals whilst on loan there from Spurs. Southend play at Roots Hall Stadium, current capacity 12,392, which they moved to in 1955. And the stadium is the largest football ground in Essex and is used annually for the Essex Senior Cup finals. And Southend are currently waiting to break ground on their new 22,000-seat stadium to be built in nearby Fossett's Farm. Conscious that we've done a Southend shirt before, I decided to look at football in general in the land of Stiletto Heels and the Permatan. Yes, XFA were formed in 1882, and they tell us that they are a football-rich county with nearly 5,000 teams playing at all levels. Not wishing to cast any aspersions, but in the 1930s, the Essex FA were twice burgled, and their senior cup trophy and junior cups were stolen, never to be recovered, and no doubt melted down to be made into large hoop earrings and identity bracelets. Thank you, Phil. Essex provided a number of the 1966 World Cup winning squad, and the Essex FA are not backwards in awarding themselves full credit for England's triumph over West Germany. Who can name the Essex born? Well, I think we can all do that, can't we? Bobby Moore, Jeff Hurst and Martin Peters. There you go. Grassroots football in Essex has 35 Sunday leagues, 13 youth leagues, as well as currently 2 football league sides and 20 teams in the National and Isthmian leagues and 18 players playing at the next level, the Essex Senior League. Players who play for the Shrimpers and the Seagulls include Christian Walton, Andy Patterson, Boo, John Keeley, David Stockdale, and of course, Guy Butters. But did he ever play in goal? But did he play in goal for a Sputz? No, he didn't.
Clarkey played there, Paul Clark.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah.
How could you miss out on him? There's many people.
Another tank.
Yeah, he's a good lad. He's a good lad. He looked exactly the same as he does now with that beard and everything. You know, he's the oldest looking footballer when he played, but he was fit as a fiddle, he was.
Now, last week, we were delighted to have Brian Horton on, Albion, former Albion captain and Albion manager, who had a book out. With the book theme, I guess it's Christmas is coming. I'm delighted to talk to another author. This is Tim Quelch, and Tim has recently written a book, Good Old Sussex by the Sea. Make of that what you will, but Tim is here on the Albion Raw. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alan.
I've just said Sussex born. Give us a bit of a background. Where you're born, where you're from, and give us a flavour as to how that's affected the nature of the book that you've written.
Okay, I was born in Hastings, but I lived for 7 years on the Netherfield Council Estate, which is just outside Battle. Mm-hmm. Because my father used to work at the gypsum mines, which was fairly close by. Then the family broke up for a period, and I lived in Windsor. But we came back to Hastings in 1960. What I've written in the book is that my first experience of football was going to see Hastings United play Norwich City in the third round of the FA Cup in 1954, a cracking game. It converted me to football. I was initially pretty dubious about football. My dad got me a football for my fifth birthday, and I tried to kick this bloody thing, and it was so heavy because of the moisture it soaked up. Do you know what those leather balls were like in the 50s? Yeah. They became so heavy, they were like medicine balls. And it just didn't seem like fun. But my dad persuaded me to go to this game, and I was just completely sort of captivated by it. Not just the game, but the crowd. There was over 12,000 people there.
Hastings, the Pilot Field.
The Pilot Field Hastings, yeah. And it ended in a 3-3 draw, which Hastings might have won had they, because there was a shot on goal right at the death that hit the bar. Had they won that, they would have gone through to meet Arsenal at Highbury. And it's just incredible that this small town club that hadn't been in existence for so long, because it was only formed in 1948, could have progressed so far. And then the following year, they did this. They had another good cup run, which had ended up with them playing Sheffield Wednesday at Hillsborough, which they narrowly lost, and arguably were robbed of a draw by a goal that should have been disallowed. After I left Netherfield and left Sussex, football became an absolute passion. The new school I went to, everybody was absolutely besotted with football. And it was the time when Chicks bubblegum cards were out. They were like hard currency in those days. My dad took me to a game at Chelsea, between Chelsea and Wolverhampton in 58. And I'd hadn't seen anything like that before. Jimmy Greaves, the first time I saw him, he scored 5 goals in the 6-2 win. You know, it stepped up my passion for the game. But we returned to Hastings in 1960, and I started watching Hastings United regularly. It was a pretty desperate time, those first few years. They were absolutely hopeless and got smashed out of sight by every team that turned up there. But I'd also managed to see Brighton. My dad took me to see them play Aston Villa in 1959. Really hot summer. The temperature on that day must have been near in the sort of the top 80s. It was quite uncomfortable. It was quite swooning, you know, there was so many people packed into there because it was Aston Villa, who had just come down from the First Division, and they were managed by Joe Mercer. And he was turning their club around. Brighton had, at that point, had stayed up one season because they went up in 58 when Adrian Thorne scored 5 goals to beat Watford. They stayed up reasonably well in with some comfort in 58-59. Despite losing their first game 9-0 at Middlesbrough. I remember a quote from Glenn Wilson where he came off the field at Ayresham Park in those days. Yeah. And he asked the referee whether he could have a touch of the ball because he said he didn't have a single touch in the game.
See, what's coming across here, Tim, is, you know, the very first story from 1954 through to 1959. It's just your absolute passion for something which hitherto had not been your cup of tea at all. Like I say, I mean, a heavy leather ball that you couldn't actually, you know, get to do anything with. And yet yours is a story of more someone who spectates rather than participates. I mean, I'm sure there's participation, but when it's the spectators, when we have old Albion fans on the show for the first time and we ask them about their first experience of the Goldstone, a lot of them, it's their first experience of football. Now, clearly with you, it's you've had Hastings United, and 12,000 at the Pilot Field is something to behold, but you also went to Stamford Bridge before you came to the Goldstone. But there was, there must have been something about going to the Goldstone, you know, even if the fact you can remember it sort of 60 years later as being such a hot day that, that actually sort of fired something within you again.
Yeah, the heat was one thing. The other was the crowd. I mean, they were so loud. It was a terrific din.
And it's an open stadium as well.
It was, it rivaled what I'd heard at Stamford Bridge, where there was 60,000 in to watch that Wolves game. I was rooting for Brighton immediately because they were the underdogs, I thought, you know, because Aston Villa had come down to the first division.
Not because they were the local side.
Well, to me then, it wasn't local because I still hadn't moved to Hastings.
Oh, I see.
You know, my dad took me down from Crawley where I was staying with some relatives. The train was packed as well. Brighton, you know, put up a damn good fight. I remember enough about the game to remember just to sort of how much effort was going into their performance. Villa had a guy called Peter McParland on their side, and he was terrific. I knew of him, but on that afternoon, he was ostensibly a left winger, but he was everywhere. And he was so good in the air. He was putting in these thumping headers, you know, sort of in the midst of a sort of a morass of players. It's quite remarkable.
See, also, so what comes across here again, Tim, is the passion, is the fire, and clearly of a young boy or a growing boy who has these memories. And I don't suppose even then you wrote them down. But when we get forward now to the current day, and this is obviously what I wanted to ask you onto the Albion Roar about, was the nature of the book. And I've read bits and pieces of it. And it's not just a book about football. There's football and cricket. It's mostly the Albion, Hastings United and Sussex. And when I'm reading the cricket bit, for instance, I'm reading it with John Arlott in my head. You know, with those sort of like lazy, hazy days of summer, that kind of thing. So when you talk about the Albion against Aston Villa as a heat wave, you can't really necessarily put two and two together. I don't think I ever recall going to the Goldstone in a heat wave. It was never like that. But what's come across is your passion for sports growing up as a younger boy through the 50s, through the 60s, and all the various journeys that you've been on. This is what is the foundation of good old Sussex by the Sea. So moving on to this time, and because if you start telling the stories now, you're going to give away the book and see how and what the ending is. So tell us about how the book came about.
There was several reasons why I decided to write this book. One was the nostalgia, because I'm still very committed to Sussex. I've managed to get back for a week about a month or so ago, and I love the place. It's still home to me, even though I live in a beautiful place, Skipton. Sussex still has a great hold on me. I wanted to write a book that was a testament to my deceased parents, because my parents, in their different ways, got me involved in sport. Although they're gone, I thought that I wanted to do something to dedicate the memory to them. I think that I wanted to say something about the teams that had were my first loves in sport, which were Brighton, Hastings and Sussex County Cricket Club. And I also wanted to write a book to raise funds for the British Lung Foundation. A couple of my friends died from incurable diseases. And it seemed to be a good cause to support, particularly in these difficult times. So that was the basis of why I did it. I thoroughly enjoyed writing it because of, you know, sort of raking over the memories. I still got a pretty good memory of the event 65 years ago. I can't remember my PIN numbers or bloody birthdays or air anniversary, which I got into trouble with the other week. But I can remember this Brighton game back in 1959.
Yes.
I can remember every Hastings game I've seen. It just stays there. I thought I'd like to get it down before, you know, sort of lack of capacity catches up with me.
Great though, Tim, and isn't it great how childhood memories, which are often the most fond, but are also the purest as well. And I think it is so important that, that people do write them down and pass them on. You know, the ancient art we have of storytelling must prevail.
Yeah, the other thing about it was that there was so many good games that I saw during that period. But I think one of the important features about this time in Sussex watching sport was that it really turned me on to the underdog. Right. I'm much more drawn to teams that struggle to sort of to punch above their weight to survive than I've never been a glory hunter. Mm. I mean, I had a taste of it at Chelsea. Chelsea then were a struggling team. I've always followed teams that have been, you know, that found it difficult to survive. When I went north in 1968, when I left Sussex, after a year or so of up in the north, I started following Burnley because Burnley were once a very big team. Mm. But when I was starting watching, they were really struggling. And so the same trend has perpetuated over the years. And
basically, it sounds like you're a jinx.
Yeah, well, maybe so. I mean, certainly we could have said that about because of my first games at Brighton all resulted in losses.
Right.
So yeah, you may have a point, but believe me, it was much worse at Hastings. I went through a season only seeing three victories, but it had a points tally of less than 20.
Ouch. So,
yeah, I know. I sort of realised that point. That I must be a pious flagellant.
So if anyone was to have a copy of Good Old Sussex by the Sea, what would they be reading? Clearly, many memories over the past 60-odd years, but what would they be reading? What would they be catching up on?
Well, there's the standouts, I think. I think that I went to... there's a number of games that stood out for various reasons. And what I've attempted to do was to sort of to capture those games, not as only just the how I memorised them, but trying to sort of to mug up on some of the, you know, the reports in the local papers of the time and so on, to try to sort of to give some real colour to the occasion. And all of the games I describe in this book, and what the reviewers have said, he said it's like going to the football with you.
Right.
It's like seeing these games again through your eyes.
So these are totally arbitrary choice matches that you went to, but the ones that mean most to you.
Yeah, there is an arbitrary element about it, but I did try to pick out the ones that made the most impact. I mean, the game between Brighton and Villa, where Brighton had a centre forward who had no right to be playing football. He had polio as a kid, as a young man rather. And he incredibly managed to survive that, to have a successful football career at Millwall as well as at Brighton. I also saw Brighton play Leighton Orient in April of 1962, and Brighton was really, really struggling. They had a guy in charge of them who was a brilliant coach, George Curtis. Mm-hmm. And he was absolutely hopeless at Brighton. I managed to find some pieces in the paper where the players were sort of berating him as being such a hopeless manager. But he was a brilliant coach. There's people from all over the country, really top players, people like Bob Wilson, who played for Arsenal and Scotland, rated him as one of the best coaches that he ever come across. But as a manager, it was an absolute disaster. But I did see the Brighton-Burnley game a year before. Burnley were then the league champions, and Brighton were a lower mid-table side in the second division. And it was an absolutely phenomenal game. I mean, the weather was appalling. And the game, as I say, was an absolute cracker, a 3-3 draw. It was real end-to-end stuff. And Burnley knew they'd been in a game.
Good Old Sussex by the Sea, a 60s childhood spent with Hastings United, the Albion and Sussex County Cricket by Tim Quelch, is published by Pitch Publishing and is available for £12.99. But exclusively to the Albion Raw, we have a signed copy of the book to give away. I started reading. I'm actually loving it, so I thoroughly recommend it. And if you wish to be within a chance of winning a copy of this signed book, Tim, could you furnish us with a question?
Earlier in the show, I mentioned a player for Brighton who had polio as a young man, who went on to play successfully for Millwall and Brighton. Who is he?
Okay, so just to reiterate, if you wish to have a chance of winning that book, earlier in the show, Tim mentioned that there was a Brighton player who also played for Millwall, who went on to have a successful career after contracting polio as a child. Which player are we talking about? If you want to have a chance of winning this book, send your answer to, on an email to, thealbionroar@yahoo.co.uk. That's thealbionroar@yahoo.co.uk. And we will select the winner from all the correct answers on Friday, the 27th of November. Good luck to everyone. And it just leaves for me to say thank you very much indeed to Tim Quarles for joining us on the Albion Raw. As I say, Good Old Sussex by the Sea is available at Pitch Publishing. If you wish to purchase a copy of the book, it'll be www.pitchpublishing.co.uk. Tim, thanks very much indeed for coming on to the Albion Raw.
Thank you, Alan. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, that was great talking to Tim. He had so many more memories. We could have had an entire Albion Raw show made out of that. But yeah, good luck in the competition there. Fabulous book worth winning. Talking of fabulous books worth winning, AD, last week we had a competition.
Yes, we did. And thank you for everyone who entered to win the fabulous Brian Horton book. Brian was an excellent value last week. I'm sure you all agree. Brian asked the question, who scored the other two goals at Newcastle after he opened the scoring for the Albion? And of course, the answers were Jerry Ryan and Peter Ward. And we had a number of entries on this one, but I can officially announce and say congratulations to Matthew Horrocks. And we'll be in contact with you soon to get your contact details and a signed copy of Brian Horton's book, 2000 Games, A Life in Football, will be winging its way to you very shortly.
Well done, Matthew. Congratulations.
And you must have had some dealings with Nobby over your time there, Guy.
Yeah, I played. I'm not sure I played against him. I think I did. But certainly played against teams that he'd managed. Yeah, great competitor. Amazing. 2,000 games. I'm assuming that's as a player and a manager. That's yes. Some sort of going, that is.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, the last time I spoke to him and got involved with him was the theatre day with Peter Brackley when he came down. So he was very, very keen for that as well. He came down with his wife, I think. But thoroughly charming man. And, like I say, an absolute massive competitor on the pitch.
Yeah, and we'll talk to you. We've spoken to you at length about Brackers before, but he's a great loss to us all, isn't he?
Yeah. Every day, I sort of think about him. It's something reminds me of him. It'd be something stupid or funny or something ridiculous, you know. And it just reminds me of him.
Give us his best lines about you, then.
It was the best one, obviously, is the one he used to introduce all the time. You know, when I played, I looked like a Greek god, and now I just look like a Greek restaurant. you know, all the usual slow ones, you know, deceptive pace, etc.
Yeah.
Slow work, you know, all the other stuff. But yeah, great man, you know. Oh, and lately as well, there's been a lot of stuff on Twitter with the Saint and Greasy stuff as well. And you know, when he stood in and done for the spitting image puppet, and he'd done the voice for it. It's just fantastic, man. Yeah, like I say.
So Guy, who would win in the race, you or Pascal Gross?
Do you know what? It depends. I might have to give him a head start. No. to be fair, funny you should say it. I'll take up a bit of time. But we, with our students, like I say, in the further education stuff, we're always getting games to watch. And we had watched Man City Monaco a while ago when it was 5-3. And just pointing out to the lads that you haven't got to be the quickest on the pitch as long as you've got a bit of a footballing brain and you can see danger early. You know, you can get yourself in good positions. And I think some of the top players that haven't got as much pace, I think that's why they're there, because they've got that extra little bit upstairs.
Like Darren Curry.
Yeah, you know, Darren, you know, good player. He literally both two-footed. You know, you didn't know what way you could show him to stop him from crossing the ball in the box. You tried to keep him on his weaker foot as such, but he could still whip a good ball in with his left foot. So, you know, it's like I say, I never had pace. I was quite lucky. I never ever had pace. So I always had to be two steps ahead in my brain, really. You know, and unfortunately for some people who have got the pace, when they lose it, if they haven't prepared in their mind, then it shows.
Okay, guys. Well, let's bring it forward to present day. And I mean, there's been a few issues with the team at the moment where we're playing absolutely wonderful football. Everyone's giving us massive plaudits about the style of play, but we're not getting the points that the performances have deserved. So if you were in that dressing room, what would you do to change that?
I think the key thing is what you said. I think they're playing well. I think if they weren't playing well and still not getting the results, I think it'd be a bit of a worry, but they are playing well. I think they're creating chances. It's just unfortunate that they're not going in the back of the net. I think it's key that Welbeck gets fit. You know, you've got to probably give him two or three games to get match fit. But from what I saw of him in the last game, I think he looked quite sharp. It's unfortunate that he had a chance. The keeper had done a good save. But hopefully, you know, it's always one of them cliches, isn't it? You know, I think sooner or later we're going to give someone a bit of a tonking, and hopefully it'll be sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I mean, obviously with the current situation, I mean, with the empty stadiums, I mean, do you think that comes into it at all? Because I mean, sometimes fans can suck the ball into the net, can't they?
Yeah, I mean, you've only got to see some of the silly results that are going on. You know, normally that would never happen at all, would it? I mean, I follow quite a few clubs in lower leagues as well. I mean, Sunderland lost to Mansfield the other day at Stadium of Light. Now, can you imagine a full stadium like rocking with 30, however many thousand people in there? There's no way they would lose to Mansfield. You know, but that's the way it is. It's surreal. You know, it must be. I watch it when you've got the crowds, you know, the noise in the background. Obviously, when they're there in the stadium, there's no noise whatsoever, and it's just shouting from each other, players. It must be really surreal to play in that situation. It's almost, it must be like a training game as such, you know what I mean? But yeah, you just got to make the best of a bad situation. But I'm pretty sure, like I said, they're playing well. That's the key thing for me. If they weren't playing well, I think it'd be more of a worry, but I'm pretty sure that'll turn a corner sooner rather than later.
I mean, here's hoping. On Twitter, it was actually one of the better Barcelona sides, and the caption read underneath it, Aston Villa when they played the top six. Now, thankfully, they're not playing the top six this weekend, so here's hoping.
Well, this is true, but I mean, I've got a question here, actually. I mean, it's like, dear guy, I'm a 6'3" centre-half and I constantly bust the gut to get into the box for corners, from which I scored 3 goals last season. Should I be miffed that they keep taking them short? Yours, Adam, 25, from Chichester.
I literally would be fuming, because not only that, you know, if you go up for a corner, big centre-half like I was, it's a nightmare. You made an effort to get up there. You know, you've got to run back. It's a nightmare. The worst ones was when the ref used to overtake me running back. I used to track, leave off, ref. You make me leave off, ref. Slow down a little bit, will you? But yeah, certainly why change it? If you've got balls coming in the box and you've scored from them, it doesn't make sense to take a short corner. And the amount of times it happens when you see someone, even in the Premier League, when they score direct from a corner, someone hits the ball in the back of the net. To take the next one, do the same thing. Do exactly the same thing. Get some joy out of it. It does make sense to make to take a short corner.
I don't think I've ever seen anyone score from a short corner.
I can think of one, Aidan. I can think of one. The equaliser against Arsenal during lockdown. But that's about it.
It's funny you should say that, Al, because that is about all we've got time for on this week's show. So thank you to everyone for listening. Thank you to Guy Butters. Thank you to Alan Wares. Thank you to Tim Quelch. This has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm Andy Packham, and we'll see you next week.
Up at 8, it can't be late for Matthew and son. He won't wait. Watch them run down the platform one and the 8:30 train to Matthew and Son. Matthew and Son, the work's never done, there's always something new. The palms in your hand, you take them to bed, you're never ever through. And they've been working all day, all day, all day. Break, and that's all you take for a cup of cold coffee and a piece of cake. Matthew and Son, the work's never done, there's always something new. The pause in your head.
hand, you take them to bed, you'll never ever blue. And they've been working all day, all day, all day. He's got people who've been working for 50 years. No one asks for more money, cause nobody cares. Even though they're pretty low and their rent's in arrears. Matthew and Sam. Matthew and Sam. Matthew and Sam. Matthew and Sam. And they've been working all day, all day, all day.